This is the Fantastic Books Podcast,
the fantasy and sci-fi book review podcast for fantasy fanatics, book nerds, and lovers of lore and stories.
Covering some of the most loved fantasy series as well as brand new novels.
With your hosts, Anna
and Sam. Let's see what we're reading this week. Welcome back, fantastic listeners. This is Sam.
And Anna.
And I am so excited to be coming back to the Kingkiller content world, covering Patrick Rothfuss's new story, The Narrow Road Between Desires, illustrated by Nate Taylor.
So this book, I'm sure, as most of our Kingkiller fans know, is an extension of the Lightning Tree story. Patrick Rothfuss worked on that, I want to say, 8 years ago? I don't quite remember. I've never actually read The Lightning Tree. I don't believe you have either.
No, and from what I've heard from many sources, it's better to have not read that story and take this as a completely fresh slate.
Okay. Yeah, I have heard that there's a lot of overlap, but a good amount of change. And because this was expanded, I want to say to almost double the length or even more than that of The Lightning Tree. And then originally it was supposed to have, I want to say, 10 to 12 images, and Patrick Rothfuss and Nate Taylor expanded it to 40-something images. This is a much more comprehensive story than The Lightning Tree was. We get a lot more background information, and the story has expanded quite a bit, so yeah, even though I wish I had read The Lightning Tree a while ago, I'm glad that we now have it in this form. And I know there's a lot of controversy on people saying this is a bit of a money grab or a cop-out because it was already a story. I don't know if I really want to talk about that or if I want to just talk about like the content of the book itself.
Well, one thing I would like to expand upon since you did bring it up is the fact that we have Patrick Rothfuss writing again is encouraging. I think he has a lot of work to do with book three, obviously, but most importantly, dropping the ball with that charity and chapter release was not a good look. And
yeah, it
wavers my willingness to support his content. However, my love for reading is what is inspiring us to put forward this episode. We love that universe. We enjoy the characters. And for that reason and that reason alone, we continue to cover this type of media.
There has been a lot of discussion among fans because this book actually came out with a lot of merch alongside it. So you can buy Embrils. There's a bossed sexy calendar. There's all sorts of weird things that you can buy now. So it does look a little bit bad. People are saying it's more of a money grab after the charity event. And I do think that it's in poor taste to not address the charity, that he should have released chapter three or at least made some sort of statement on it. But I think in this case, we can kind of separate the artist from the art, because I do want to talk about this new information we have, this expansion on some of our characters. For, like you said, a series that we do really love, and I don't think Patrick Rothfuss is a bad person. I think he just didn't really honor a promise.
Right.
He's no J.K. Rowling.
Oh, absolutely not. But,
so,
you know, again, if you collect donations for a charity and you have those donations with the expectation that you are then going to render a service, honor that pact.
Right. The money still went to the charity, so I'm okay with that part, but agreed. I would love to see chapter three. He did release the prologue, so we got something out of the charity event. Not much. You know, the prologues are pretty standard at this point.
Yeah.
There's always the same sort of language in it. So that didn't expand the world too much. I'm not going to hold my breath for book three, but I am excited to talk about what we have now, The Narrow Road Between Desires.
And might I say, if you have not picked up a physical copy for yourself, or at least digital, do yourself a favor and at least skim through it. The illustrations by Nate Taylor are gorgeous. I absolutely love them. I really appreciated having visual references in one of his books.
Okay, I don't love the illustrations.
It's funny you say that. I feel like normally with fantasy, I don't need pictures. I don't need a picture book. Yep. You know, description should speak for itself. But I feel like due to the whimsical nature of this story, this kind of lend a hand to it. I know some readers might argue that the illustrations were just a way to kind of buff out the story and have a higher page count in order to slap a new coat of paint on it and make it a bigger book. But I thought it did a good job creating more substance to noir.
I don't think it was just like a way to buff out the book. I think Nate Taylor's a really good artist, and I think that the drawings are very well done. I think it was more just a stylistic choice for me, because I think in a fantasy world, you could have art that's a lot more whimsical and intriguing. And these are highly realistic looking pictures.
That's very fair.
And I think it just didn't quite mesh for me.
That's fair.
Like, I think they really bring the world to life, but almost in a way that...
the tone doesn't reflect the actual tone of the story.
Yeah, because Bost is Faye, but we have these, like, very, very well done pictures of people. And I think sometimes that's a really hard thing to capture in fantasy, especially fantasy art is like faces and people. Stylistically, it almost reminded me of the pictures in the Magic Treehouse books.
They did.
So it was just a little bit, I don't know, it took me out of it a little bit. I think they made more sense in Ari's book because they were a bit more stylized. We had a lot of really dark and moody pictures in his other book. And these are, obviously Bost's story takes place during the day. It's like really well lit and bright. So that style does match what the descriptions are. Like the pictures are accurate to what is happening in the story. I just don't know if I felt like I necessarily needed some of the like big, big pictures. I liked more like the doodles, the small pictures of the Embrils, like the details, but the full pictures of characters, I think took me out of it a little bit.
That's very fair.
That being said, though, we do have a lot of characters in this book, and we haven't even talked about what the story is about. So do you want to just give a little debrief on what happens in the story?
Yeah, so as a generic overview before we get into some more of the finer details, this book is just a day in the life for Bost in noir during his life while he stays with Coat, you know, Cavoth, but at this point Coat, at the Waystone Inn. And at first we get all these shenanigans that Bost runs into and some of the chaotic actions that, and hijinks that he does throughout the town and his interactions with the children. And it's funny because when I was first reading this, I was kind of like, all right, I knew right out of the gate that this was going to be similar to A Slow Regard of Silent Things, that it was a story, but in my head, kind of like a nothing of consequence story.
Right, because I think there's so much riding on book three, he can't add in extra details in these other books that would affect the stories too much.
Right. But I was very pleasantly surprised by the end of the story. We do get a cohesive plot line that gets finished, and it was very heartwarming, and I really enjoyed it. I think what I enjoyed most about this story was that it perfectly captured the essence of those long summer days you experience as a kid.
Yep.
Where you do so much and it just is such a good feeling. There's like such a tone of nostalgia with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really enjoyed the story for what it was.
I agree. I actually did really quite like the story. I liked seeing what Bost got up to during the daytime, because he is a bit of a side character in the main series, and he's intriguing. There's a lot of depth to him, and I think it built out the town quite a bit more. We learn a lot more about the people in the town, how big it is, just sort of like some logistical things where you can really flesh out what their life looks like in the frame story. But like you said, it all comes together. So as Bost is going about his day, all these children come to him. They meet him at a place called the Lightning Tree. Obviously, you know, the name of the original story. There were some fan theories, which I thought were really interesting, that the Lightning Tree is the tree that Kvothe calls lightning down upon in Wise Man's Fear. But I think a lot of people dismissed it because that means that the Eld would have to be pretty heavily settled by the time the frame story is happening.
Right. And at that point, it'd only been maybe 20 additional years.
Exactly. So I don't think that stacks up. I liked the idea of it, though.
Yeah, I think it, as a plot, that would be really intriguing. However, I think in actuality, it's unrealistic.
I agree. So he meets children there. They know to come to him if they are, I think they have to be shorter than, is it the Greystone that's fallen over nearby? So he makes deals with young children. a lot of the times they're really silly things. Like one girl comes asking for help with a kitten.
One of the kids is being bothered by his brother. He wants to get back at him.
That's right.
At one point, we do get the main...
the deal.
Deal and conflict, so to speak, with Reich. But it's interesting where we get these little snippets in the beginning of these children coming to Bost with secrets to trade and favors and requests of him. And I love the idea of these kids bartering with secrets and favors and Bost instilling hijinks amongst the townsfolk just because he's bored.
I think he's bored. I think there was a great line, too, close to the beginning about, like, I don't know if it's specific to Bost or if it's all the Fae, but, like, the bartering is so natural to them. It's like watching a master artist at work. You can see him weaving these, like, plots and plans and sort of pulling the strings of the children in the town.
Yeah.
And some of it is to get what he wants, and some of it is to just, you know, like you said, hijinks and instigating fun and silliness.
Yes, and I do really appreciate the negotiations that transpire between the children and the boss. Some of the kids are actually very thoughtful and considerate and keep Bost accountable for what he owes them and vice versa. So it's fun to see the interactions and the dialogue. I really actually enjoyed it more than I think I was expecting to.
I did too. There was actually quite a lot of dialogue, I think, in this book compared to, well, especially Slow Regard, there's hardly any.
Yeah.
But I think he did a really good job with the dialogue, and I think he captured writing from a children's perspective quite well. All of the kids had their own unique personalities, but they felt like real children. And I think that's something that sometimes authors, as adults, have a hard time capturing.
Yeah. I think what's interesting to me is what came across my mind after I read it for the first time was, this truly kind of was a fairy story where you have, you know, Bost being your fae character, but you have all these situations and actions and moments of chaos that happen throughout the story, but then there is an overarching plot and lesson to learn from it. I think that is a sign of a well-done story.
I was quite impressed with, like, the overarching plot. So what happens in this bigger plot, essentially, is this boy, Reich, comes to Bost. There's some sort of like beef between the two of them from a previous deal that we don't get to see.
Right. I believe Reich did not honor the terms of the agreement in a previous dealing, and Bost has been burned, so to speak, by it.
So in order to get Bost to talk to him, Reich actually sends another boy in the town, Kostrel, to talk to Bost on his behalf. And he actually gives Bost a gift. And it's pretty important because Bost specifically says, I don't go in for presents as a rule, but makes an exception and accepts this gift from Kostrel, who's a boy that he really likes. And then as he receives the gift, there's this sort of weird moment where he's experiencing or expects to experience like a feeling of captivity almost. It says like he was expecting to feel the leash pull tight around his neck, but didn't. You know, he's almost expecting to be bound by this. And I think that's something that's really important in the King Killer universe, is that gifts can actually bind you in, like, a magical sense.
Yeah, because they always say, at one point, I think Kavold says, it's a gift freely given without let or lien.
Yes, yes. Oh, my God. You're right.
Yeah.
Yes. And so then when he finds out that this gift is actually not from Kostrel, but from Reich, he realizes that he's bound now to see Reich later on.
Yeah, and in the description of it too, it's very, again, classic Rothfuss's empowering flowery language.
I think he describes it as similar to the way that Bost feels when he touches iron, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So I think that's pretty interesting. Other people have been making some fan theories about the power of gift giving. I forget who made the theory, but someone was talking online about potentially in the main story, Kvothe gives the ring that's Denna's from Ambrose. He steals it from Ambrose and gives it to Denna. But people were worried that there's like potentially an accidental binding of Denna to Ambrose.
Because it wasn't a freely given gift.
Yep. And so like how Kostrel here is the middleman giving this gift, Kvothe may have accidentally been the middleman giving the gift to Denna.
Ooh, that's fascinating.
And we know how powerful rings are. And I think the gift here that Kostrel gives is a teardrop-shaped token.
Like yes.
A penance token. the stone on Dana's ring is teardrop shaped. So people are trying to draw parallels there.
I like it.
It could be dangerous. I hope she's not bound to Ambrose, but...
Ugh. That, like, on a larger scale, would be such an explanation of why Coat is such a hollow version of himself.
Ugh, if he did it by accident?
Yeah.
Ugh, that would suck.
By his own hand. So, due to the fact that Kostril has now essentially acted as a mediator to bind Bost to Reich, he is not happy.
No, Bost does not want to do it, obviously. He's mad because Reich has wronged him before. But the whole story is them sort of getting through this precarious situation. And I think there's a worry on Bost's behalf that Reich knows his true name. Or accidentally said it once.
Or his at least true nature.
There's something going on with that. It's alluded to. It's not quite clear.
Well, especially too, there's a really interesting conversation they have about the Fae. And they're talking about Glamoury and Grammoury.
I think that's between him and Kostril.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Thank you.
Those are the two kids he spends the most time with. So I got a little... They're mixed up a little bit.
But yeah, there is this moment where the veil's almost lifted. And Bost almost gives away too much information.
Yes, it's a little scary. He does give a little bit of detail on some Fae magic, which we've heard about before. A lot of it is Glamoury and Grammoury.
Yes, and Bost goes into some detail about how Glamoury can make something seem other than what it is. He could make a white shirt seem blue, could make blonde hair appear silver white or dark, and... Obviously, Boss being Fae is using Glamoury to seem more human-like than what he is.
Right. He drops it a little bit in the book later when he's bathing. There's like a moment where it says if you are an astute observer, you would notice that his legs under the water don't look quite human.
Yes. And as Boss is answering these questions for Kostril, the deep-seated fear kind of wells up in him, and if his next question is, how do they make their glamour, or worse, how would a clever young boy break it, he then is worried that he'll put himself in a position where he may have to make sure Kostril isn't around anymore. And thankfully, this internal dilemma is immediately squashed, because Boss likes this kid, and he couldn't do such a cruel thing.
It reminded me of the scene, though, when he goes a little bit wild on Chronicler and threatens him, because we do see how dark Bost can be towards humans. But the other magic he discusses is Grammoury, and I still don't have quite a good concept of how that works.
So I get the concept that Grammoury could be a subset of naming.
Okay.
And how in the Creation War... People were, again, in the Fae realm, making things be, making things more of what they were. They were taking already existing elements and objects and transforming them into a grander thing, where the namers or the knowers were against this. So I think this is kind of like the deep-seated origins of what naming became.
I could see that. I could see naming and sigildry and the other types of magic we have in the world being deviations on Fae abilities. So Grammoury and Glamoury are definitely more of some things that Fae can do sort of naturally. It's almost like, I think he specifically says, they think of them as arts or crafts, and they're like seeming or shaping. So again, that reference to like the shapers and the namers. So I could see... the magic that humans have on this side of the Creation War being less powerful versions of the Fae magic that they have on the other side of the world.
Yeah. And again, just as like as simplistic terms as could be, Glamoury being more of a optical illusion and Grammoury being more of a change of substance and essence and wholly changing something, which I think is a really interesting allegory because... In a way, Bost, by the end of the story, uses Grammoury on Reich and his dad. By changing their circumstances, he changes Reich into from being so self-loathing and hurt and sad to a boy with a second chance. and he removes his dad for being like an abuser and a selfish person, which allows Reich to have a more stable home and become a better person.
So there's a big scene where Bost is doing a lot of this sort of magic, and it shows Reich and him going around the lightning tree multiple times in order to fulfill Reich's wish of removing his dad, which is like the deal he strikes up with Bost. But in this scene, Reich goes up the hill to the lightning tree multiple times, and there's almost like a weird time lapse that Bost is playing with.
It's very cinematic in my mind. You could see how it would play in a movie with like the sky moving and shifting.
So my interpretation of that was that like Bost had spent his whole day doing all these things, you know, just interacting with people in the town. He went and he drank some of Crazy Martin's like liquor in the woods.
He collected honey and chopped wood for Reich's mom.
Right. But like he does all these things that have impact. So like after he comes back at one point, he's like a little bruised up and you're like, oh, is that from chopping wood and collecting honey? But then once he goes and does the like time lapse thing, I think he's actually going and doing all of the things that happened to Reich's dad.
It's like off screen.
Is he like time turnering?
It's definitely time turnering, but I think it's more to like fulfill the needs of the children with the deals that he's made and also allow the events to transpire in order for Crazy Martin to chase off Reich's dad out of town and force him to take up coin for the king and join the army.
Right. I agree. I was saying, like, is Bost essentially using the things that he did to like glamoury and grammary the whole day into a different story? So like, you know, he went to Crazy Martin's still.
Yeah.
Did he essentially like change time and change like the way things looked to everyone else, where he was the one who was there, but everyone else thought it was Reich's dad?
Oh, I don't know.
It was just a little confusing to me.
That's fair. I'm not necessarily against that idea. I just never considered it, so.
Because, like, a lot of the things that he did during the day were parallels with what happened to Reich's dad in his story.
Yeah, that very well could be. I don't know if I'm necessarily convinced by that, but it very well could be.
I'm not necessarily convinced either. I just don't really understand how Bost made all those things happen in places that he had already been during the day.
Yeah, I don't know. Kind of confusing. But ultimately, I guess it's just one of those things where I kind of just interpret it as like, it was a very long summer day. And it very well could have been like a time turner and Bost like adapting his roles multiple times to allow events to transpire the way they are meant to be.
Okay.
I think the frustrating part is that Fey magic is super unclear.
Yeah, it's very unclear, and we're not really sure what he was doing with that scene where they're going around the lightning tree multiple times. Like, is that glamoury? Is that grammoury? Is that something else entirely? I don't know. We just sort of get the conclusion from the townsfolk of like, this is what happened today. Reich's dad went to Crazy Martin's still and drank all the liquor and then got chased around. And then he fell, got hurt, and had to leave town because he didn't want Crazy Martin to keep chasing him for revenge. So it worked out where Reich got his wish that his dad left, but in a way that no one had to kill him.
Right.
But he's permanently gone, so like the solution has presented itself.
Yeah.
I thought that part was pretty heartwarming, though. Like, I did feel really emotionally invested in Reich's character once we realized what was happening to him and to his siblings and his mom.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm never gonna support like child abuse and a terrible dad, so it was glad that he was able to be removed in a non-violent way.
Right.
One thing I don't really care about this book for is there's like an unnecessary amount of like thirst for Bost happening in the village.
Yeah, I was wondering if we were going to talk about that.
Like, don't get me wrong, I get it. He's Fey. There's like that allure and essence that's like makes him irresistible. And like, you see little snippets here and there in Wise Man's Fear, Name of the Wind, as far as like Bost being intriguing to the townspeople
and being like an attractive young guy. Of a level, though. Like, there was a lot of heavy references and Like, I'm not a prude in any sense of, like, what I like to read or anything. Like, that didn't bother me. It just felt more like there's a lot of really popular books right now about, like, the sexy fae.
Yeah.
And it just felt like a really tired trope. And I think Bast is a lot more intriguing of a character. And, like, you and I already had a lot of questions about, like, his magic and his abilities. But to spend some time on, like, sexy scenes instead just felt kind of like filler.
Yeah, like, I didn't... So, unnecessary scenes to me was, like, him bathing and, like, three or four townswomen, like, ogling.
Yep.
Like, roles reverse. Like, a lot of people would have an issue with, like, a chapter like that.
Yeah, like, I didn't love that one.
And then the chapter with Reich's mom, where he was like, anything else I can do for you?
What the heck happened there?
It was
there?
Very, like, the movie Holes, like, I can fix that. But, like, I can't tell if he was, like, trying to seduce her, so then...
It definitely seemed like it.
She would be less sad about, like, the husband leaving?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't mind the scene with Emberly because that was, like, completely consensual.
Right, and they, like, clearly have a relationship.
Right, so that was fine. The scene with the mom really confused me because it was so opaque as to what was happening.
Right, and then at first in my head, I'm like, is this how Bast is going to get back at Reich? And be like, he's going to sleep with his mom?
I thought for a while that Bast might be Kostrel's parent because he had, like, such an affinity towards that kid. And I think they're described as having similar, like, personality traits. And yeah. I was like, Bast, what have you been doing in this town?
I mean, he's just running amok. But I don't think it's necessarily any of that. Like, I do understand, I think, the intent of Patrick Rothfuss's writing of Bast being alluring and getting into shenanigans in a town that's in the middle of nowhere and, like, passing the time while he's learning with Kavoth, but...
Especially because the only other fae we've seen is Valurian, and every scene with her is a sex scene.
Right.
So, like, that is the type of fae that's in this world. They're the sexy fae. But, yeah, for such a short book, I didn't really care for it.
Yeah, I just felt like, since none of the other books necessarily dive into romance, with the exception of Valurian and, like, the Losi scene... coming back from the Fae Realm, it didn't really do anything to progress the plot.
I agree.
I think it was just gratuitous, which, like, again, I'm no prude either. You know, I read Fourth Wing and Iron Flame, but it was just, it felt like all of a sudden I was like, who's writing this?
I think the thing with sex scenes, again, if they're gratuitous, it's sort of like, what is, you know, a gratuitous scene is like, what is the point of this? And I don't really know who the audience was for that in this scenario. And it's like, at that point, you may as well describe, like, every single thing a character does. Like, they can go to the bathroom and they can brush their teeth. Like, you wouldn't include stuff like that. So if you're going to include these scenes, they need to move the plot forward.
Right. It'd be one thing if it was, like, you're reestablishing or a change in relationship dynamic between two characters or...
These are characters we're never going to see again, though.
Yeah. I was just like, again, it felt like filler.
Right. I got to the point almost, too, with, like, how many kids Bast was seeing before we got to the heart of, like, the Reich story. I was like, all right, even this feels a little gratuitous. Like, is this just going to be a book where, like, every chapter is a new child showing up?
Right. All these favors and stuff. So, although, you know, we are, our overall consensus is that we liked the story. It did feel cumbersome, and not in the way that Slow Regard of Silent Things had felt, where, although that was...
That was like a meandering story.
Yeah.
This one was...
clunking, and it felt like if you're running through the woods and there's a lot of, like, bushes and shrubs in the way.
It was weirdly paced.
Yeah.
It felt very heavy on the back end,
mm.
with, like, everything kind of coming to light.
So, I think overall... I'm glad I read it. I'm glad that there is more content in the Kingkiller universe. I'm excited that this will hopefully open a gateway for more writing in an eventual book 3. There are so many wonderful stories in fantasy and sci-fi that I've been enjoying covering and reading in my spare time that it's taken the, like, sting out of no book 3 for me.
I think that's fair. I did feel inspired to reread Name of the Wind after reading this one.
Oh, for sure. Because,
like, it rekindled my love for all the characters.
Mm.
Speaking of which, one thing I thought was interesting is Kvothe / Coat is never mentioned by name at all in here.
I think just Reshi.
I think he says Reshi. People were trying to argue that this happened after Coat or Kvothe was dead, and it was a new innkeeper.
No.
And I was like, there's no possible way, because isn't Shep still alive?
Shep's still alive.
Like, I think this is takes place before Chronicler even shows up.
He's been called Reshi in the story, but they even say the innkeeper with the red hair, so just no.
Yeah, I thought that was an interestingly specific and weird fan theory that I came across, because when I was doing research for this, I was really, really surprised. There's hardly any fan theories out about this book yet. A lot of people are just taking it at face value. And I do think, like you and I said, there's not a huge amount to theorize on or say is going to influence book three. I do think the main points that came out of this book were information about the Fey magic. And then one thing that we haven't talked about yet are the Embrils.
Yes, these Embrils are out of a small pouch, and they're like tokens or knuckle bones used for fortune telling or making predictions of someone's future. And there's some very interesting Embrils in this assortment. There's one that appears to be a coin with an oil lamp. There's one of a woman's face. There's one of a closed eye. There's one of a horseshoe, a candle, a crescent moon. There's one that shows the symbol of the Emir on a teardrop shape.
So at one point, Bost pulls some Embrils with Kostril, and they both do a different reading of the same tokens. So Bost pulls the moon, a woman sleeping, and a lamp unlit, which he interprets as a long walk for not much road. And then he also pulls the piper, which is overlapped by a closed eye, which is saying the piper is asleep too. And then he also pulls the candle and the stone arch, which might mean a journey, but also related to the woman they pulled earlier might symbolize a dream. And then the last one that they pull is a crown, which Boss says is authority or rule or even domination. And then Kostril reads them differently. He looks at the woman and says that she's a queen and she's not sleeping, but she is crying, because she's sad that her tower is broken. And then he pulls what Boss called the moon, which is the crescent-shaped piece of horn, and says it's a bowl or horns, but not the moon. And then he also says that the piper isn't sleeping. He's lost. He's in the dark because the lamp token that he pulled is unlit. So he's maybe blind or lost his way. He's supposed to play, but he doesn't know how anymore.
Which I just realized those are both parallels for Kvothe and Ori, because they talk about the moon and a girl or a queen or princess sleeping in a broken tower, and that's Ori and her under thing.
Oh, okay.
She's not dreaming, but she's cracked.
Ah.
So she's not lucid like everyone else. And the piper could be an allegory for Kvothe because he doesn't play his music anymore.
Which falls perfectly into the last interpretation of Kostril, which is the unlit candle, which he says represents wasted potential or fire that's waiting.
Yeah, what I tell you. What I tell you.
Yeah, so I think that this actually takes place before Boss arranges for Chronicler to come. Mm. I think there's an offhand comment in the beginning of the book talking about how people write books because they know everything, and so that's where Boss gets the idea that someone should write a book covering Kvothe's life, and so it's almost the inspiration for him to call Chronicler. And I think these Embrils really symbolize the different characters, like you said. Obviously, I think Kvothe is quite symbolized in a lot of them as the blind piper or the lost piper. I was interested in the crown potentially having something to do with, like, the king that gets killed.
Ooh, yeah.
And I do think the candle obviously is important because we see them come up so many times between Ori. We see Tarbalin has his coin and candle. So I think the candle can come up many, many times. The one I was also interested in was the one that they describe as a dreaming or a weeping queen, because of that line about Lady Lachlis. She's been sleeping, but not dreaming.
Yeah, good point.
So I think there might be a little way to interpret them, something to do with like the Lacklasses, and then the arch might be the four plate door, or like the Greystone arch, some kind of like gateway between. I think maybe more
the Greystone arch and the Waystones.
Yeah, so those are quite interesting. There's no fan theories out there on those yet, which I was quite surprised by. They also foreshadow a little bit what happens directly in the book. Like, I think Bost pulls the piper one, and then he's, you know, he makes a set of pan flutes and plays the pan flutes, like, while he's hanging out. So it's immediate foreshadowing, but I think big foreshadowing for the book as well.
Yeah.
So overall, I think I'd give this like a 7 out of 10 for the story. I enjoyed it. It's not as rereadable as the main books for me, but it was a pleasant little story, and I felt more attached to Bost's character by the end.
Yeah, I think the one big takeaway for me with this, again, was it was nice to get a snippet of noir. It was great to get more of Bost because he was certainly more of an enigma.
Yeah.
In the main series. So I always enjoy more lore, but I agree with that sentiment. I don't know how much rereadability there is to this.
Yeah, I might reread it one more time just to see if I can put the Emeralds into place for what happens within this story.
Mm.
Like what they foreshadow in this very book. But I think it would be more interesting to see how they might play into what happens in book 3. hilariously, a YouTuber we do like to watch said the very last picture in this book is of carrots, which is what Bost is tasked to collect as per Kvothe's orders at the very beginning of the book, and made the joke that this is just Patrick Rothfuss dangling a carrot in front of us, and we'll never get book 3. But I'm slightly hopeful.
Hopefully we're proven wrong.
I would love to be proven wrong, because I love that series so much. Obviously, that's what we founded the podcast on. You and I love to pick it apart. And I did really enjoy this little dip back into the series.
Yes, it's been great to jump back into the world. And I'm hopeful that there'll be more Kingkiller content to discuss in the future.
Yeah, so if you have any fan theories, if you have read The Narrow Road Between Desires, please reach out and send us a message. We'd love to hear what you all think. And until next time, listeners,
happy reading.
Thanks, listeners. If you're looking for more, check us out at fantasticbookspod.com, where we have book reviews, reading list suggestions, merch, and you can even send us a message.
Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at Fantastic Books Pod.
And if you like what you've been hearing, don't forget to leave us a review.
Thanks.
Golden Rise Media.